This is The Takeaway for Monday, May 15th, 2017.
We did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information.
We had a very nice dinner, and at that time he told me, you are not under investigation, which I knew anyway.
The president had lost, again, like I said, he'd lost confidence in Director Comey.
I was going to fire Comey. My decision.
This is ultimately the president's, always going to be the president's decision. Everyone who serves at the pleasure of the president.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening on this Monday. And it's a Monday where the search is now on for a new FBI director. That's after former director James Comey was fired by President Trump just 4 years into his 10-year term. The firing was shocking in some ways. Comey, of course, was leading the FBI's ongoing investigation into possible collusion, but also other potential connections between Trump campaign officials and Russia. We learned last week that a grand jury has issued subpoenas for the records of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who was fired for lying about his own contacts with Russians. With a week where so much happened in Washington, with conflicting accounts of how it happened and certainly more entanglements to come, we want to start our show today and this week stepping back for a minute and looking at where we are now in the story of the president, the FBI, and Russia. Michael Scheer is White House correspondent for The New York Times, and he's here to help us do just that. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good to be here.
Great to have you. And let's listen to the president in his own words from the interview with Lester Holt on NBC. It was the comment that really not only confused a lot of people, but spread a huge amount of concern around Washington and the country. Listen.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
Michael Scheer, it's unclear if the president thought he was just making a banal throwaway comment. But when you listen to what he's saying that when I decided to do it, the Russia investigation, the fake story or whatever it is, was right in the very front of my mind.
Right. And in fact, that has two really serious implications, I think, and what made us all real concerned across Washington. One is the substantive question, which is if he really was thinking about Russia when he fired Jim Comey, then it's pretty clear, or at least you can interpret pretty clearly, that maybe he fired Jim Comey because he wanted to obstruct or hinder or somehow stop the Russia investigation, which after all is an investigation into his own people. The second implication, though, I think is even, is also pretty serious, which is it really undercut an entire 48 hours of stories that his staff, including his vice president, his press secretary, senior advisors, were all saying that this wasn't about the Russia investigation. And in fact, it was, you know, about concerns that Jim Comey had been unfair to Hillary Clinton and that he had been a sort of incompetent FBI director who had lost the faith and support of the agents at the Bureau of Investigation. So, I mean, that one statement in a nutshell really undercut a lot of what the president and his staff had been saying and really raised a lot of concerns.
So it seems like in this increasingly convoluted timeline, Michael, we have two separate issues. One is the critical issue of the investigation, the integrity of the investigation, whether the president is trying to undermine it or somehow manipulate it. That's one question. And then the quality of the information, the honesty or the access to information that the White House communication staff has. And those are two very separate things, it seems to me. So let's stick with the investigation itself, because right after the president made this statement and it was aired by NBC and everybody saw the interview with Lester Holt, came a series of tweets, one of which said he better hope, it said, and I'm paraphrasing, he better hope there aren't tapes of our conversations referring to Comey. Here's Sean Spicer when reporters like you in the briefing room asked about that tweet.
I don't think that's not a threat. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on.
What are the legal implications of a veiled threat, even in the form of a tweet, or the possible legal implications of it?
Well, I think, you know, he's president of the United States. The legal implications, if you took it all the way to the end, could be that if people thought he is really threatening the former FBI director in the interest of a cover-up, that the Congress could move to, you know, to remove him from office. I think we're a very, very long way from that. But I do think that what is fascinating about this president is that he has not shied away from, doing things that raise the specter of Watergate. I mean, taping systems in the White House were made famous by Richard Nixon, whose, you know, voice and recordings and his paranoia and all of the stuff that we now think of when we think of Richard Nixon, that all came out because of the tapes that were in the White House. And the fact that this president would raise the specter of having tapes and using them against the former FBI director is pretty remarkable.
You sit there every day. What's the quality of the information that Sean Spicer and Sarah Huckabee Sanders and everyone else there is getting from the president? And more importantly, what's the state of their honesty with the press and the public right now?
Well, right now it's not very good. And look, I think it's important to say right off the bat that it's not like, you know, it's not like it was always rosy with former administrations. I got into, you know, a number of fights with the Obama administration through the 8 years that I covered them. And there were certainly times that we pressed the press secretaries in that administration to be more honest. But this administration has gotten off to a really bad start. Obviously, Sean Spicer, on his very first briefing the day after the inauguration, you know, offered information that turned out not to be true at all. And I think increasingly what you've seen is a White House that press staff, Sean Spicer, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, they just gets out there and sort of improvises and throws facts out, sometimes not having talked to the president, sometimes, you know, with information that is coming from other parts of the White House that's dubious. And I think we're in a position where there's just not a lot of trust between the reporters that are in that room and the people that are standing up telling us things.
I want to talk about some of the timing of this last week in January, not only when the president had this dinner, I guess on January 29th with James Comey, where he allegedly asked for his loyalty and was denied it by James Comey, but also things earlier in the week. Sally Yates, who was the acting attorney general, as we already know, had gone to the White House and told the White House counsel, hey, Michael Flynn is not telling the truth about his contacts with Russia. You guys are unwittingly lying on his behalf. And by the way, his underlying conduct is a huge problem. She went and told him that. At some point, Tom McGahn, the White House counsel, turned around and told the president that. Michael Scheer, do we know if the president already knew about the Flynn problems on January 29th when he turned around and said to the FBI director, hey, I want your loyalty?
You know, I don't think we know 100% what that timeline is like. And I think that's one of the questions that hopefully would be answered in one of the many investigations into this question. There's certainly folks, more folks that are going to testify in front of some of the congressional committees, and hopefully some of that will come out. It's a really, that weekend is a particularly important weekend in this whole story, not only because of the conversations that Sally Yates, then the acting attorney general, has with the White House counsel about General Flynn, also because of this dinner, but also because that was the weekend that the White House travel ban went into effect and kind of blew up and erupted into chaos. A lot was happening that weekend, and it all sort of culminated inside the White House, and we're sort of slowly learning all the different pieces and how they interact.
So James Comey was invited to speak with the Senate Intelligence Committee in closed session this Tuesday. He declined that invitation. We understand now that he's saying he will testify, but only in open court, as it were. It's not a courtroom, but only in open testimony. What are your big questions for when and if James Comey speaks to senators, speaks to the nation? He's not going to say anything classified, but what do you want to hear from him?
Well, look, I think that while we can't expect him to tell us the details of an ongoing investigation, I think what we can expect, or can hope anyway, is that the former FBI, now former FBI director, can detail his interactions with the president of the United States. I mean, those conversations between an FBI director and a president are normally not something that you would expect either person to talk about. But let's face it, they go to the core of this question of whether or not the president of the United States was trying to impede an investigation, ultimately firing the sitting person who was in charge of that investigation. So I think, you know, my expectation is that certainly the Democratic senators, but also maybe even some Republicans, will press former Director Comey to be as forthcoming as he can about the exchanges that he had with the president.
Michael Scheer, how much can an FBI director, or removing an FBI director, really slow things down when an investigation is this high profile? It seems like shutting it down completely would be politically toxic. That's not possible. I had one FBI source tell me over the weekend that career people at the agency are affronted and offended at what's happened to Jim Comey. And that person said, this is just the beginning They didn't elaborate on that, but it seems like people are pretty mad.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there's sort of two different pieces to this. One is, as you say, the people who are actually conducting the investigation, doing the interviews, sifting through the records, you know, doing all the stuff that is that's not the sort of high profile, but it's the behind the scenes stuff. Those people are career people. They're not political. They serve under presidents of both parties. And they are, if anything, likely to be motivated to be even more aggressive if they have the sense, which I think many of them do, that the investigation is trying to be kind of impeded or stopped. I will say, though, my former colleague at The Washington Post, Bob Woodward, who, of course, has covered the most famous of these, the Watergate investigation, has made the point over the last few days that, in fact, the director of the FBI matters, that when those people who are the investigators come and say, I want to interview that person, I want to, you know, pursue this course in the investigation, that the director can say, no, I don't want you to do that, or I'm not giving you the resources to do that. And so should the president pick somebody who, you know, is loyal to the president to the extent of trying to stop the investigation or slow it down or impede it, the FBI director has a lot of power to, if not stop the investigation, at least slow it down some.
Michael Shear, we're going to let you go. Before we do have to look forward to a new nominee to run the FBI. There's going to be a Senate confirmation process. Chuck Schumer now says no nominee, no approval until a special counsel is approved. He'll need some Republicans to come along with him on that. Where does this head in the next week or two?
Well, I think that depends on the developments, what we hear either in testimony, for example, if Comey does testify, or if there's other leaks that come out. If there's other shoes to drop, then it's possible Republicans could join Democrats. Otherwise, keep in mind that the majority is a very powerful thing. And I think that, you know, if we don't hear anything else in the next couple of weeks, that you may find the Senate able to and the president able to push through an appointment over the objections of the Democrats.
Just when Washington struggled to recover from a week when shoes dropped one after the other over and over, another week begins as the Senate is back in town and a new FBI director may be appointed within days. Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Sure. Happy to do it.
It's being called the biggest ransomware attack in history. Computer systems around the world were hit with malware last week. The attack installed malicious software on computer networks at the British National Health Service, but also at universities in China and the Interior Ministry in Russia and many other places as well. The software is called WannaCry, at least one of its variants is, and it infects a computer's files and essentially shuts down the entire system. Then it demands about $300 payable in Bitcoin to set that computer free. It is a hostage situation. One wrinkle here is that the virus seems to exploit a vulnerability in Microsoft's operating systems originally discovered by the National Security Agency, and now there are reports that some attacks may be using malicious software developed and leaked from the NSA itself. Agencies are now trying to recover from the cyber attack, but network administrators and their bosses across Europe and around the world are worried about what could happen as workers come back from their weekends and flip their computers back on. Joining me now is Nuala O'Connor. She's president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology and former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security from 2003 until 2005. Nuala, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Thanks for being with us. This attack spread extremely quickly to systems around the world. Maybe we can't get too technical, but how do malware, ransomware attacks like this spread so fast and so effectively?
Well, the primary modus obviously is the code in your computer, and the attackers looked for computers that had not updated their patches, which many of us are guilty of doing. It's, you know, kind of a big pain in the tush when you see that little sign come up on your computer that says, please update your software to the newest version. That leaves you vulnerable to attacks that exploit basically problems in the code, what are called vulnerabilities. It's easy to do once you know what the code problem is. And this code issue or vulnerability was discovered by the NSA and we would say the word hoarded by the NSA in its desire to be able to know where the vulnerabilities are worldwide in the code. Microsoft acted quickly to issue a patch when it was discovered, but that doesn't mean everybody around the world patches their computer on a daily basis or an hourly basis. So it exploited what is a very normal thing, vulnerabilities in code.
Now, we have to come back to the question of this vulnerability discovered at the NSA, because there may actually be secret NSA code that's helping drive some of these attacks. That could be important. But I want to talk about when a big agency, a company, it's one decision for a person, I suppose, if your personal computer gets taken over by ransomware of this kind. How does a giant government agency like the NHS in Britain, let's say, with hundreds of thousands of computers, how do they decide whether or not to pay? Clearly, there are all kinds of competing incentives in a hostage situation. You don't want to have to pay, but you need your files back. How do they go about that decision?
Well, so obviously, like in any ransom situation, the government and others always advise not to pay because it encourages hackers, attackers, criminals to act again in the same way. Obviously, that's a very difficult decision for someone in a healthcare setting. And let me first say, my heart goes out to the folks at the National Health Service. They have been on the front lines of these kinds of attacks and some self-inflicted wounds a few years ago when they lost their own laptop and disclosed a whole bunch of patient-sensitive information. They have been in the kind of hot seat of information governance and security for a long time. They are also subject, as our own federal agencies are here in the United States, to very limited budgets. And so again, I have sympathy and empathy for the folks working in information security, particularly in the government sector and particularly in healthcare. And if you see some of the stats about poorer hospitals in the United States, even only spending 2-4% of their budget on cybersecurity, whereas financial institutions can spend almost up to 25 or 30% of budget some years in cybersecurity defensive measures. So again, I'm sympathetic, particularly in healthcare, where you have life and death decisions and you need to have that information and those systems online in real time. Our advice, obviously, to the individual user would be not to pay any ransom, but rather shut down your computer, get to your local tech guy or gal and have them help you. It is surprising, on the other hand, though, that there were some for-profit institutions around the world that were hit very hard, some telecoms, some transit companies. And it does show that cybersecurity is an evolving threat. It is a daily, hourly, you know, minute-by-minute defense. It is, I don't want to use the hyperbole of this is war, but it really is. For those of us who've been working in information governance for decades, we'd say this is not a surprise. It's been a cat and mouse or a cops and robbers game for many, many years. And it really, the onus is on both government and private sector actors alike to take very stringent security measures to protect their systems, because we're now talking about, again, life and death situations, not only in hospitals, but as we move into the Internet of Things, Internet-enabled cars, things that move, things that could hurt you, the stakes are that much higher.
Indeed. And Nuala O'Connor, you said that the individual has to get right to the local tech guy, have them try to help you get out of it. What if the local tech guy in this instance is the NSA itself? There are many implications, many of which we probably never know about. If NSA code was stolen from the National Security Agency and is part of this attack, but that probably means that only the NSA can help combat it. Can they help get rid of WannaCry and ransomware without giving away more secrets?
Okay. I'm not sure that the NSA is actually helping in this situation. Let me say also, your tech guy or gal, I've got lots of
sure.
of good gal girlfriends who are working in tech security and vulnerability disclosure
Indeed.
Issues. The NSA here, I would argue, is not actually the good guy. They hoarded this vulnerability. They were aware of it. They did not disclose it either to Microsoft or to the individual user in a timely fashion that allowed people to take the remediative measures that were necessary to protect themselves, all in the name, again, well-intentioned national security, cybersecurity, and frankly, surveillance authorities that the NSA is trying to use. But here they did not help us help them ourselves, and in fact prevented people from knowing about this vulnerability in a timely fashion. They also lost it, right? They lost this code. They lost the code, again, the other codes that we're talking about, through an attack on their own systems, which really leads me to the question, is the government well positioned to protect the kinds of things they are asking for companies and individuals
and to help
to give
with those.
Them?
Right, and to help with those defenses, Nuala O'Connor, President and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, former privacy officer at DHS. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Boston earlier this month, Baltimore Orioles All-Star Adam Jones was in the outfield during a game at Fenway Park when a Red Sox fan threw a bag of peanuts at him, yelling racial slurs including the N-word. The team apologized and ejected the fans in question here. It was a response that Adam Jones called pathetic. He said the penalty should have been much more severe. But the very next day, another racial insult was hurled from a fan in Fenway's bleachers at a woman singing the national anthem this time. And this time, the Red Sox banned that fan from the ballpark for life. David Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine. He's host of the Edge of Sports podcast. And he says the many players who've come forward describing similar experiences has a new focus on Major League Baseball and what the league should do about ugly fan behavior. Zirin says, especially in Boston, there's a lot of work to be done.
I mean, the Boston Red Sox have made the choice to broadcast their games on a radio station, WEEI, that has had numerous talk radio hosts suspended for racism. Numerous. It is well known as the station that you turn to if you like a little bit of racism with your sports coverage. But it's also the most popular sports radio station in the entire New England area. So with the Boston Red Sox, it's like in word and in deed, they are trying to show that they're taking this more seriously. But for myself and frankly for a lot of other people that I have spoken to, both inside Major League Baseball and journalists who work Major League Baseball, they have said to me, in effect, call me when the Red Sox pull their games from WEEI. Until they do that, institutionally, this idea that racism goes with baseball like peanut butter and jelly is just something that we're just going to think is the way that things are.
Let's talk about the difficult subject of policing speech. Now, Fenway Park is a private venue. Major League Baseball is private as well, so I guess that goes with the territory. But in places of public convening where ugly speech and ugly language happens all the time, Dave, you get into the zone really quickly of speech policing, and it is a tough place to be.
It is, and also it has to be said that even in ballparks that are funded with public money, they are in effect private space. So that public money magically transforms into private property as soon as it goes into a stadium or any sorts of other kind of venue. So even though we would think that there should be constitutional protections because it is this public sphere, that's not the case in practice. And that's why in practice that Major League Baseball has all the power to do something about this. Now, policing speech, you're absolutely right, is a very tough thing to do. And how do you determine what is hate speech, what isn't hate speech? I mean, I could just see fans being thrown out of games because they're not standing during the national anthem. And Major League Baseball says, well, that's hate speech because you're showing disrespect towards our country. I mean, we see ways that this can be twisted in all sorts of ways. But I'll tell you some things that Major League Baseball would have the power to do. They would have the power to say that racism is the line and that a fan would be ejected for life if a racist incident occurs. They would also have the power, and this might sound a little bit scary, but I bet you it would clean things up mighty fast, that if a fan is confirmed to have yelled racial slurs at a player, take his picture and post it online. Because so many of these fans are people who they live this one life, particularly when you think about the cost of tickets at Fenway Park. They live this very respectable middle-class life, and then going to the ballpark is the place where they're able to basically vent their hatreds. And if this was more public and less kind of anonymous and trollish, that would stop things.
Well, Dave Zirin, what are players saying here? I mean, to be a professional athlete means to take abuse from fans. Saying you stink is not the same thing as racial epithets, but I bet if you convened a group of old black players who played in the major leagues from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they might say, oh, are you kidding? This was my whole career, this kind of thing.
Wow. Well, first of all, I got to end with some bad news on that part, because having talked to a lot of players and a lot of other folks in baseball management about this, is that a lot of people think it's something that's gotten worse over the last 2 years than in, say, the 80s and 90s. So, yeah, there's a reckoning with how to deal with that and how to hold the line against that in Major League Baseball. And, you know, we'll see how they do. But what most players say is what Adam Jones said really well, which is he said, you know, yell at me, say what you want to me, but, you know, please, like, treat me like a human being.
Dave Zirin of The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And let's go to Texas now and to Dallas, where West Dallas, in many ways, has always stood apart from the rest of the city. West Dallas has transformed from an industrial to an urban community, but it's pretty much always been poor. Then 5 years ago, the brand new Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge was built, connecting West Dallas to downtown Dallas. And that bridge brought change. Fancy shops, restaurants, and high-rise apartments sprung up in West Dallas, and now many longtime residents can't afford to stay. KERA is exploring the changes in West Dallas with its new series, One Crisis Away, No Place to Go. KERA reporter Courtney Collins says the speed of gentrification is beyond what many in the area expected.
Not all of it has been ill-received by the community, even the low-income community that's been there for a long time. There's a lot about it they're happy about. They're happy to see vacant lots that were full of mosquitoes and standing water cleaned up and constructed on. But there's a lot of concern, too, because there are so many people in these weathered rent homes that were built in the 1940s that just really don't feel like they fit in with all of the changes.
Of course, with development comes cleaner blocks, probably less crime in some places, as you mentioned. It also brings higher rents and places where at least people used to be able to get by where maybe they can't anymore. Who have you been talking to?
One person that's kind of a great example of what you just mentioned was Ashton Elder, who's been in West Dallas forever, has four children, has been living in one of these older weathered rent homes that we'll talk about in a minute. And before that, you know, sleeping on couches and people's floors. Here's what she has to say about all the changes in her neighborhood.
I'm not knocking the changes that they are doing because there's nothing wrong with improvement. I just feel like, me personally, I think it's wrong that they're trying to kick us out and take over. Don't take over. Come and join us.
So here's one person who embodies that conflict or maybe that duality that you just talked about. Improvement is good, but we want to keep living here.
Right. There's this group of weathered rent homes owned by a company called HMK Limited. They were built in the 40s without really the oversight of building code. This was, again, before West Dallas was even a part of Dallas proper. And the city of Dallas strengthened housing code enforcement policies last fall. And once that happened, these rent homes were considered no longer up to code. Now, the landlord that owns these homes, most of them are in the West Dallas area. I think more than 200 of the 300 homes that are kind of under this HMK umbrella. He said bringing them up to code, up to the new standard that Dallas adopted, would be impossible. It would be instant bankruptcy. So he's decided to shutter the rental business. The city and HMK came to an agreement and said, okay, we're going to let these families remain in these homes till the end of the school year, which is June 3rd. We won't fine HMK Limited in the meantime for code violations, but that is kind of the end date for them right now. And there's so many families really don't have a plan in place yet. One person I've been spending a lot of time getting to know is Joe Garcia. He's also lived in West Dallas his entire life. He takes care of his elderly mother. He just doesn't really have a plan and is kind of hoping for the best.
Hoping the best comes out of it, you know, that they will hear us out and see if they can come down to a decision and help out, you know, because, I mean, people been here all their lifetime, and it's hard for them to move out, you know. Like I said, it's a community that they just come and take out.
Courtney, what does the city say here as the arbiter of all this between the developers, the private interests, and the people who live there? And is it resting well with the residents of West Dallas?
The city of Dallas makes the point over and over again that, look, we have to have code enforcement standards that are adequate. We can't just have people that are middle income or in the middle class enjoying housing standards that are adequate. We have to make it fair for everyone, including low income families. That's kind of the point that they have made over and over again of tightening code enforcement standards. Here's Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings.
It's not just for people with money, but for people that don't have money. And we've got to have clear standards. And I'm glad we did that. It's hard because policies have implications and it creates change. But I think ultimately we need to raise the bar for families that live in poverty.
So looking forward, Courtney, what kind of mix is West Dallas headed toward? That might be the key question because everyone wants development. Everyone says they want to treat the residents right. In the end, what does all that look like?
There are still always going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, some homes in West Dallas that are older, that are owned by people who have lived there for generations, smaller houses. Those that are owned are not, you know, in immediate danger of anything changing. These rental homes were renting for as little as $300 or $400 a month. We're talking 2- and 3-bedroom single-family rental homes. There is nothing else like that in West Dallas. There's nothing else like that really in Dallas at all. These new apartments that are going up in West Dallas rent for $1,000 a month for a 1-bedroom or a studio and go all the way up to in the 2000s. obviously people that are used to paying $300-$500 a month in rent are not going to be able to re-rent a newly built apartment in the neighborhood they've always known. And that's the point that the HMK Limited co-owner and landlord of these homes, Krish Krish, has kind of made over and over again. He kind of blames this fast movement on the city of Dallas.
Now that the city is imposing this deadline, I think clearly shows what the city's real agenda is, which I have been saying from day one. The city's agenda is to displace these families, is to clear out West Dallas in order to usher in higher-end developments.
Is there a threat that Dallas becomes like so many other cities now across the country where in the city core, in the city proper, low-income folks just can't afford to live anymore?
I think the argument can be made that Dallas is already there. I mean, I spoke to someone with the National Low Income Housing Coalition about the story, and Dallas, as it stands, has 19 affordable units available for every 100 very low-income families. And so that means, you know, we're talking 80% of people who need low-income homes don't have one right now. So I think for so long, kind of the rhetoric surrounding North Texas and Dallas has been it's fairly affordable, and compared to other big urban areas, maybe it is. But Dallas is certainly developing quickly, and there's not that many affordable places on the market for the very low-income families that need them.
Courtney Collins with KERA in Dallas. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Turn down that racket. I said turn it down. How many kids have heard that from how many parents across the generations? Part of becoming an adult, unfortunately, might mean that you think the younger generation's music is just noise. Pop music isn't fine art. The Stones aren't Mozart. Rihanna isn't chamber music. And Adam Bradley says it's easy for us to miss that the music we rock out to really is art.
Music has a way of enchanting language, of bringing parts and sounds and qualities out of words that otherwise you might not notice.
Adam Bradley is the founding director of the Laboratory for Race and Popular Culture at the University of Colorado, and he's author of the new book, The Poetry of Pop. And he says the history of pop music is closely tied in with poetry itself. A good place to start is with pop music that really is poetry set to music, like the work of Leonard Cohen.
There's a blaze of light in every word. It doesn't.
Leonard Cohen's a great example, and you could think as well of the troubadours that we often associate with great songwriting of that era, whether we're thinking about Joni Mitchell and, of course, Bob Dylan. So many of their lyrics blur the distinction between poetry meant for the page and poetry meant for performance. Now, certainly that was the case with Leonard Cohen, where he had a career as a poet in the more conventional sense of writing for the page. But his lyrics embody a different aesthetic. They employ much more repetition. They employ much more rhyme than his page-borne poems. So he changes the way that he writes depending on the context. And that's an obvious point, but it's something that enriches his lyric space.
Now, a lot of people have no difficulty discussing Leonard Cohen as the poet, as the troubadour, as you mentioned. But you go for a surprise here, and you come right out of the gates in this book with Rihanna and her huge hit, Diamonds.
I saw the life inside so shine tonight. You and I were beautiful like diamonds in the sky.
Most people don't want to think of that type of pop music from the club or, you know, the pop radio station at the top of the dial as real poetry.
It's exactly the case. I think that poetry is not an honorific. It's not solely a way of saying that something is elevated or elegant or beautiful. It's also a descriptor. It's a way of saying that these are artists who are dealing with language in concentrate. So the poetry is both in the lyrics themselves, you know, shine bright like a diamond. I mean, it's a serviceable but not a particularly inventive simile. But in Rihanna's voice, it becomes something much more powerful, much more anthemic.
Well, let's go back a little ways to the Beatles, because you talk about the Beatles in this book and you talk about Let It Be, which is a classic Beatles song with lots of repetition, total pop song of its age that's become almost a legendary song. But I want to talk about Hey Jude, because as soon as I was reading about Let It Be in your book, I thought of the simplicity and the repetition and the sing-along style of Hey Jude. Let's listen.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song. start to make it better.
Adam Bradley, nice simple melody there. The lyrics are really simple. And by the end of this song, you and I are locking arms and rocking back and forth and going, na, 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 you know, together, and we all know where it's going.
Oh, yeah. I could take this lyric on the page into my freshman poetry class and teach my students about rhythm and rhyme and structure, teach them about the equipoise, that beautiful balance of syllables across the lines that are the sign of the exercise of true craft. And that is the poetry of pop in a way. But then that locking arms that we were talking about as well, that is equally, if not as much, a part of the poetry of pop as the structured and ordered lines in McCartney's first part of the song. I mean, there's this magical moment around 306, 307 of the song where Paul lets out a scream. And then the guys come in with that na, 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 na. And it's repeated for close to 4 minutes. It's almost a full minute of fade out as well, where we're to imagine that the party keeps going beyond the 7 minutes of the song. They're probably still locked in arms today singing it. You can imagine it like that. And that's the marvel of what pop music can do that page-born poetry can't.
So while we're on that page, let's talk about the Rolling Stones, because you talk about satisfaction. I want to talk about two different versions of the same song, because I sort of felt like it might give us an example of how the same lyrics can have a very different poetic feel in the hands of two different artists. So let's listen to Mick Jagger and the Stones here with their classic Satisfaction. Same lyrics and a very different vibe, you say. That's what I say.
I can't get no satisfaction. This is really a study in rhythm. And with Mick, you hear him almost pulling the words like they're taffy. Can't get no, you know, and doing this back and forth thing where it's rough and smooth and extended and clipped. With the Devo version, it's so much more aggressive, leaning forward in the pronunciation, in the rhythm, and in the relationship to the frenetic track as well, that it's a wonderful version. You took me back by playing that. I haven't heard that in a minute.
You talk about lyrics and you talk about rhythm and rhyme, of course. We have to have a hip-hop section of our discussion. Who is the singular master of rhythm and rhyme and cadence? Is it Tupac? Is it Biggie? For me, it's Tupac. I don't know about you.
Well, to me, it goes even further back than them to Rakim, one of the great masters of the art of emceeing by virtue of his rhythmic play. Let's trace the hits, check the file. Let's see who bit the dot, check the style. I flip the script so it can't get filed. At least not now, it'll take a while. I changed the pace to complete. As a child, he played saxophone. And you can hear the runs that he makes rhythmically on his greatest songs. You can hear a sense of a musician's ear. In 86, with a melody and a president's mix, and I would stay on track and refuse to miss. And I still make hits for beats. Parties, clubs, to me, that there's fun in all of it.
There is a lot of fun in all of it. And, you know, I wish there were a big warning label on the front of your book, and I think there should be. A warning, do not read without your Spotify account activated. I mean, it's a wonderful book, but it's only when you get the music going and you match them to the music that it really jumps out. And I just think that people should read this book along with the ability to listen to the songs that you're talking about.
Yes, that's it. It's a love letter to centuries worth of music.
Adam Bradley is professor at the University of Colorado. He's author of The Poetry of Pop. Adam Bradley, what a pleasure.
It was great, Todd. Thank you.
That's The Poetry of Pop. Give us your take, 8778MYTAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. You can tweet me. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You don't have to speak, just see. And peep the technique.